The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City and video streaming live as well. You can go to progressiveradionetwork.com or garyknoll.com. Today, the latest on healing from foods like watercress and nutrients like alpha-lipoic acid for a wide variety of conditions. All of this, of course, comes from the peer-reviewed literature. Then, a little more in-depth on nutrients to help you with macular degeneration. Now, that's what most people end up going blind from, macular degeneration. And that'll be information from Dennis Gearhart, a PhD. Also today, in my guest segment, two guests. Ian Henshaw, who is a leading British investigative journalist, we'll be calling him in England. He is the author of the book 9/11 Revealed, the New Evidence. And he's raised a lot of new concerns. We're going to take a look at some of the new information. And also today will be Barbara Honegger. Now, I have never met her. I met her yesterday at a 9/11 symposium where I was one of the keynote speakers. And I'm going to thank those in this audience who came. It was sorry that you couldn't get in. I mean, it was just mobbed. Clear out on the street, people were waiting. And she is the person who used to work at the Hoover Institute and joined the Ronald Reagan administration as a researcher and policy analyst back in 1980. It was while working for Ronald Reagan that she discovered information that convinced her that George Bush Sr. and William Casey, head of the CIA, had conspired to make sure that Iran did not release the U.S. hostages until Jimmy Carter had been defeated in the 1980 presidential election. Now, as many of you have heard me on previous shows long ago in the past, I believe that there's compelling evidence for the truth of an October surprise, meaning that that the people at the very top of the administration intentionally made sure that the American hostages in Iran were not released until after Reagan became president, because he could then take credit for doing it. Today, she's going to share new insights of why she believed, based upon her research, that the attack on 9/11, specifically and only the Pentagon part of this, has been a story that is not correct. So we'll find out what she has to say on that. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. So much, I don't think we'll get to calls, but we still will go to your questions that you've sent here. And Elizabeth is in studio, and she'll be asking those questions. As you know, if you have diabetes or know someone who has diabetes, there's a big chance they're going to develop neuropathy. And neuropathy is a major problem. And you lose your sensory motor skills. You don't feel things the same as you did before. Well, this is from the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care. It says that a trial using alpha-lipoic acid could help retard the progression of diabetic distal symmetric sensorimotor polyneuropathy or neuropathy. That's big. When you consider the high percentage of diabetics that suffer from neuropathy, quote, in our four-year treatment with alpha-lipoic acid in mild to moderate diabetic conditions of polyneuropathy, the alpha-lipoic acid was well tolerated and associated with an improvement in neuropathic impairments. So that's good news. So if you know someone who is diabetic or anyone suffering from neuropathy, I would suggest between 500 to 1,000 milligrams and divided doses of alpha-lipoic acid per day. I remember, I guess it was around 15 years ago or so, there was a report out of Los Angeles where they were performing autopsies on young people, mainly teenagers, who had died in auto accidents, but otherwise were in outstanding health. And the surprise was how many of these young teenagers actually had tiny little pinholes in their lungs due to all the pollution, all the smog and the particulate matter in the air around Los Angeles. Now, having just returned from Los Angeles, I can tell you that the first thing you notice when you haven't been there is how much smog there is. You'll find yourself coughing, your eyes running, your nose running. But people who live there develop a tolerance for it. But that doesn't mean the tolerance is good. This is the latest. This is a major study, and it says one out of four adults age 35 or older is likely to get the serious lung disease, COPD, by the time they're older. Now, this is a 14 years worth of research that was concluded on this, and it's, quote, an unrecognized chronic obstruction pulmonary disease epidemic. All right, so you're talking about one in four over 35? What could cause that? Yes, if people smoked, but what if they don't smoke? They're still susceptible. That's airborne particulate matter. That's your air pollution. Indoor air pollution and outdoor air pollution. Interesting, in a town like Manhattan or the boroughs, you have less outdoor air pollution because you're on the water, and as a result, when the winds come, they blow the particulate matter out to sea, and winds coming in from the ocean are generally clean air. It's the pollution that you get in your office or your home. Particulate matter, that's what they make, or particle board, that's what a lot of people have as dressers and chest of drawers and desks and tables. The formaldehyde that's used in so many fabrics, in the fire retardants and drapes and carpets, and the formaldehyde in carpets as well. So we live in an environment, work in an environment that's just loaded with toxins. Now it's showing that can play a big problem for us. So clean up your environment, get air filters, indoor house plants, and try to get as much clean air into the house as possible. Of course, in New York City, that's not always easy. If you leave a window open, a door open, 2 days later, everything has some dust and soot on it. Here's good news for those of you who are concerned about your health and concerned about the costs of being sick. And by the way, for almost 10 years, medical costs were either first or second in line for people filing bankruptcy because they were hit by catastrophic illnesses like cancer or heart disease, and the insurance didn't cover it. This is according to the American Journal of Health Promotion, which is a major peer-reviewed journal, and it says, your high medical costs could decrease by nearly 30% after 5 years of transcendental meditation. And in some population, it's actually higher because this is just meditation. And so these are people who learned how to meditate, transcendental meditation, and they did it on a daily basis, once a day, for 5 years. So what if you meditated each day, but you also did yoga each day? What if you took good foods into your body each day? So now your costs of these high medical bills are going to decrease not just 30%, probably 90%, because you're not going to be getting sick. Our number one bill in America is not defense. That's number two. At about $1.4 trillion, all inclusive, our number one bill in the United States each year for a long time has been health care. This year it will be approximately $2.5 trillion. Now just imagine $2.5 trillion. The largest single expenditure is through insurance companies. But here's how it works, and this is why those people who are on limited income or those people who are working but have a family and you're concerned if one of your kids gets in an accident, you get sick, you could be wiped out financially. The insurance company takes about 32 cents out of every dollar spent in health care. For administration, well, that also means profit. For example, some of the highest paid executives in the world run insurance companies. In fact, not long ago, one of those insurance companies had to settle a $1 billion suit with the federal government for fraud, and they had no problem coming up with $1 billion. Well, how many companies have $1 billion in cash lying around? That means they had to be making a lot of money. Well, they do. And one of the reasons that they make this money is because they have a right to decline coverage. How did they do that? Well, they have a doctor, medical doctor, who works for the company, who gets bonuses based upon frequently how much they save the company. Well, how do they save the company? Well, let's say that you have an emergency and you go in, let's say you've severed three fingers in an accident, and you go to the emergency room. You find out your insurance will only cover one of those to be sewn back on through microsurgery. Now, they all three could. The technology is there with microsurgery, but they're going to disallow the other two. In other countries, that would be unheard of, but it's a true story. Also, let's say that you're rushed to an emergency room. Your daughter's rushed to an emergency room. You have health insurance, but then you find out that it's not covering anything that was not pre-approved. Now, get the logic on this. How can you pre-approve an accident or some emergency that happens in the moment? That means you would have to call ahead and say, I'm psychic, I think I'm going to have a stroke, can you pre-approve me? And they can say yes or no. Because a true story, a mother found that the daughter was in acute distress, took her to an emergency room. The mother has full insurance. They declined to treat her because her insurance wouldn't be covered. Took her to another emergency room, same thing happened. By the time they got to the third emergency room, the daughter had died. Nobody was held accountable. No one changed their policies. So the doctor has an enormous financial incentive to say no, and you have almost no recourse. So it's all about profit. Okay, we live in a society that I would deem a form of capitalism. You could call it industrialist capitalism. That's how it all started in the 1800s through the Industrial Revolution. But it's emerged and evolved since then. For example, there's crisis capitalism, where every time there's a crisis, there's money to be made. For example, in Libya right now, all you have to do is ask yourself, was there any reasonable explanation for us going into Libya than protecting the citizens? And the answer is yes, many things. The French needed water. The French have the largest water property rights of any country in the world. They own lots of water rights. And water's a big business. How big? $400 billion a year in water. And where is one of the largest aquifers in the world? Right under Libya. In fact, Gaddafi had built a $25 billion long canal to bring that water underneath the ground so it could be used. It's clean. It's almost limitless. So that gives Sarkozy his 2 cents for supporting the war in Libya. And then again, the United States. What does the United States get out of it except better negotiations on the price of oil? But that's a big profit, plus repairing. Every road, every building, every utility, every water purification tank that was destroyed has to be rebuilt. And just like in Iraq and Afghanistan, the big money is in repairing the damage that we have caused. Billions upon hundreds of billions of dollars will be spent. All that coming from oil revenue to the major manufacturers, the Bechtels, the Halliburtons, they'll be all over that country. To the English, it's arms. Now, the United States is the largest provider, seller of arms in the world, and we're very indiscriminate who we sell it to. But Britain wants in on that action, so they now have the capacity to go in there and re-outfit a whole new army, a whole new military. And because of the recent conflict and the people wanting to stay in power who get power, whoever that might ultimately be, and there's 2,000 tribes in Libya, there's going to be a lot of fighting. What we saw in Iraq, sectarian violence, ethnic cleansing, you are absolutely going to see all over Libya. But someone's going to be giving them arms. that'll be England. So when you start to realize all the different assets, oh, gee whiz, that's a real reason to go into these countries. Yeah, it is. So pull back and look at all this, and then you start seeing motivation for anything. Makes a big difference. One other thing here, dangers of exposure to the white light. Remember there was a big push to get these lead bulbs? It turns out those lights of white bulbs suppresses melatonin 500% more than the exposure to the light of high-pressure sodium bulbs that give off an orange-yellow light. Quote, just as there are regulations and standards for classic pollutants, there should be also regulations and rules for the pollution stemming from artificial light at night. That's according to Professor Hain, University of Haifa. White light bulbs that emit light at shorter wavelengths are greater suppressors of the body's production of melatonin than bulbs emitting orange-yellow light. This is a new international study published in the Journal of Environmental Management. So what it says is this. Those little round white bulbs that you're seeing, they're heavy-duty polluters. And finally up here, for those women in the audience using birth control pills, according to Science Daily, quote, women who use contraceptives like birth control pills experience memory changes, this University of California at Irvine. Their ability to remember the gist of an emotional event improves, while women not using contraceptives better retain details. So it can impact the memory. One last thing. I've said this on several occasions in the past. If you have an opportunity to choose pregnancy where it's not unplanned, consider taking between 1 to 2 years to prepare yourself and your partner physically by detoxing, which will take about a year to get heavy metals out, because all that will impact the developing fetus, emotionally, so that you're not bringing all your unresolved conflicts into that developing fetus, and it absolutely will impact it, and spiritually, so you're giving that developing fetus every opportunity to be bathed in a spiritual light. And I've talked about how that impacts the DNA. This is the latest from child development. Researchers at the University of British Columbia and the Child and Family Research Institute have shown that parental stress during their children's early years can leave an imprint on their sons or daughters' genes, an imprint that lasts into adolescence and may affect how these genes are expressed later in life. And this was done by Professor Kober, a professor of medical genetics, and measured myelination patterns. So what this means is this. How many times have you imagined that a child is a sponge? You have an argument. The child may not understand the argument, but they can certainly understand the energy that transfers itself between two adults. Or let's say you're a single parent, you're frustrated. It may be rightly so. I'm not challenging what is causing the frustration, but any stress and distress and any inappropriate behavior or language that you're expressing, now we know that that's picked right up by the small children, and that can adversely affect their own DNA. It makes them more susceptible to damage of the immune system and disease later in life. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go into our studio before we go to our guest. And we have in studio right now Barbara Honegger, and on the line from England we have Ian Henshaw. But we have Elizabeth in studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. First of all, people went to the Truth Rally yesterday and they wanted to share that they appreciated so much your speech because it gave them a different perspective that they haven't heard before. There was a person there that spoke some comments that were slightly out of order, but you might want to address that later. Do you want to talk about that?
Which person?
There was a Native American.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to talk about that later?
I was deeply offended by him, and a lot of other people were as well. And I'm glad that the mainstream media was not there, because had the mainstream media been there, that single sentence that he uttered would have been the only thing they would have grabbed onto. He was insensitive to those who suffered during 9/11. Later, he would read a poem, and it was a very good poem. And the poem talked about the suffering of the Native Americans throughout history. And where is their memorial? Where's the homage to those tens of millions of Native Americans, North Americans, South Americans, people in other countries, in Africa? Where's the memorial to those who died in slavery, were thrown overboard a ship, and died when they were chained together because there wasn't enough food to get them all to America? And he went through a litany of this poem he wrote of all the people who had suffered, that there is no memorial. There is no day of acknowledgement. I absolutely agree with that. I believe that we should acknowledge all suffering, the suffering of the children. But then again, we have Gulf War vets who are out there who serve their country. I'm against the wars, but I'm not against the vets. They did what they believed was important, but we're not helping them now. You know, where's the honoring the vet? And I said to this one of the vets that's up on the website, I said, Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, have they come down here to help you since you're homeless? You have no food, no electricity, no medicines. You're living in the woods in a pup tent, 16,000 of you in Central Florida. No, none of them have come. So they only want to use you, the vets, in promoting America's noble efforts towards democracy building, which is really nation building in the rest of the world. But when you suffer and when you're no longer value to them in their propaganda campaign, you no longer have value. So I'm fully supportive of this whole idea. What I do not support is that being insensitive to the suffering of others somehow is justified based upon your suffering or your tribe or your guild suffering. And I turned to John Q after I heard what this man said, and I will not repeat what he said. I was so offended by it. And shame on him. And I said, John Q, if I wasn't a keynote speaker here today, I'd leave, because I don't want to be associated with this kind of attitude. And that's my own. Maybe other people felt the same way. But if you have been a victim, we have to focus on your being a victim. But if in being a victim, you then are insensitive to other people who were victimized, then that does not, one does not justify an excusing it for the other. That's all I will say on that.
Right. Thank you very much. Do you have...
One more.
Okay. There's a lady called Claire from Boston. She said she really appreciates the diversity of issues that are discussed on your show, in particular the different insights on the human condition. She says that so many people have talked about love, but from a standard homogenized point of view. She says she's interested to know why we talk about love. We all want love. We're so desperate for love, but there's so little authentic love shown in society.
Depends upon where you look. I have no problem seeing people who show love all the time. I think our mistake is that we look towards policymakers and opinion leaders. Opinion leaders are celebrities. People are well known. And they don't create policy, but they magnify policy. You see a lot of them as celebrities. So the attitude, behavior, the relationships of these celebrities frequently are then taken as a model. If this person's well-known and famous and wealthy and a celebrity, surely they are a model I should follow. And so people then get the idea of, I'll just do what they do. That's wrong, because it's rare to see people who have matured spiritually as they have gained success. in our society, the moment you become successful, you don't have to work anymore at growing in life. There was a time when we had the big Hollywood studios had coaches that would come in every day. You had to go to acting class. Today, all you have to do is have an agent, and when the agent's not snorting coke, they'll be on the phone trying to make you a deal so you can snort coke. And it's all about megalomania. It's all about saying to a person, we'll put a deal together, but is it a good screenplay? Is it articulating an idea? Is it well lit and directed? Oh, that's immaterial. All right, it's the deal. What's it mean? We're making the money. These are the people who now we see all the time, and these are the people that we get our messages from, including on love, like that Kim, whatever her name is,
Kardashian.
Mm-hmm. All right, she became famous for one reason only. She had a big ass. That's the only reason she ever became famous. She has no talent whatsoever. Then we had to see all about her life in minutia. Then we find she's going to get married, but it's not about love. There's not a word in there about love or what they share or their passion. It's about how many dresses she's going to get for free, how much she's going to make off selling the rights to the pictures. It's commodification and commercialization of something that should be private and blissful. Then you have your policymakers, and the policymakers are no different. These are the people who tell us what we should accept in all areas of life. So they're the ones who do not stop us from eating junk food. They could educate us. There's a whole generation of children who are going to have diabetes as children, adult diabetes. They could prevent that suffering. They choose not to because that would interfere in someone making a profit, and that person making a profit is in all likelihood going to give to them the campaign money they need to get elected. So who then in our elected office represents a model of love, of compassion, of sensitivity, and of spiritual values? I didn't say religious values. They all claim religious. I don't care about a person's religion. That's their private right. I care about, are they manifesting spirituality, or are they excluding others as not being as great or as gifted or as blessed or as close to God? Because that rings a bell for me. Because next thing you know, they're going to be these religious police. They're going to want their evolution taken out of schools and creationism put into schools, and they have enormous power. Could you imagine in today's world? Because creationism must deny global warming. Creationism must state, and does state, and you go down to Tennessee, you go to a lot of places, and you'll see creationism taught right along with evolution. And creationism means, for example, that Noah had an ark. Okay, all right, let's just say you're right. Noah had an ark, all right? And he had two of every beast and every animal on the earth. All right, now the creationists believe that humans and dinosaurs live at the same time. Well, must have been a pretty big ark if you could get two Tyrannosaurus rexes together. And how did they get those big crocodiles on board? And you're talking about snakes. Did they have two of every kind of poisonous snake? Like cobras, king cobras, black mambas? Crate snakes. Then you look at, I did a little analysis once, just as a hobby. It took me about a week, and I came up with over 40,000 different species. If you have two of each one, including some that would have been whales, where are you going to put a whale on an ark, right? A big bathtub? You would have had to have an ark that was over 45 miles long. So then you start to realize, do we have any proof that dinosaurs existed? And that with humans, the answer is of course not. There was millions of years that went by in the preceding period of time. But when you control, as a policymaker, the policies, you can create any myth you want. You can create the myth that the Federal Reserve is there to help us with quantitative easing. It is not. You can create the myth that Obama's going to get jobs. He will not. You have the myth that politicians care about you. They do not. If they did, Obama, by executive order, would have stopped all home foreclosures and would have refused to allow the banks to charge usurious rates that Tony Soprano wouldn't charge, just to use a debit card or a credit card. And if you're late, then your life is in bondage. Or if you're a graduate student, the next 10 years you're going to be paying off your student loan. Where are you going to have the money to have a family or to get on with your life? So policymakers create the illusion. Opinion leaders are hired to lead the illusion. and then the media gets money from the policymakers, who then get money from the people who want their policies implemented. They want their products sold. And more than anything else, opinion leaders, if we're not buying something they're asking us to, then they're asking us to love them and respect them. Now, I don't have any more time for this today, but tomorrow I'll deal with the specific topic of love, all right?
Great. Thank you very much.
Let's go into our studio right now and say hello to my guest, Barbara Honinger. She has worked as a researcher at the Hoover Institute before joining Ronald Reagan administration as a researcher and policy analyst in 1980. And while working for Reagan, she discovered information that convinced her that George Bush Sr. and William Casey, head of the CIA, had co-conspired to make sure that Iran, that was holding our hostages, did not release them until Jimmy Carter had been defeated in the 1980 presidential election. And she was later to publish a book called October Surprise. But what she's doing now with her time and energy, she is deconstructing the arguments, the official arguments of 9/11. On the telephone from London is Ian Henshaw. He is a British-based investigative journalist and author of the book 9/11 Revealed, The New Evidence. And he's raised a lot of voices across Europe. And the London Times noted the detailed scrutiny he had applied to the official government versions of 9/11 and the inconsistencies discovered throughout it. I'd like to welcome both of you. Nice to have you with us on the phone there from England, Ian.
Hello.
And in our studio, Barbara.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for having us.
Barbara, let us begin with you. I want you only to focus upon the Pentagon.
Good.
All right, and tell us what you have found are the inconsistencies between the official report and the hard forensic data. Let me state that on this program at least, and I mentioned this yesterday, I only have guests who have enough evidence to support their position that it could withstand a forensic cross-examination and a trial. So opinions are just opinions, yes, and they have no more value than anyone else's, but the hard evidence is what I want you to share with us.
Yes.
So take us through the high points of your,
yes,
investigation.
Yeah, very good. And allow me to give one sentence of introduction. I just came back from the International Toronto Hearings on 9/11, which are a quasi-judicial investigation on the legal structure of an American grand jury. And the panelists, which I call the judges informally, the chief panelist is the honorary Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the country of Italy. So this was September 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th. And anyone, including you, Gary, who would like to know more about it, go to www.torontohearings.org. And the entire 4 days of incredible expert testimony from forensic investigators of all kinds, from engineers, from scholars, David Ray Griffin, the world dean of 9/11 research, and I was the speaker on the Pentagon attack there. It was an invited presentation, and it was pre-vetted for only hard forensic evidence, just so that you know.
Okay, let's go through the Pentagon.
Right. So now I'm going to very briefly summarize for you my presentation at the Toronto hearings. Okay. The bottom line of the conclusion from the evidence, which I will summarize for you, is that the real story at both the World Trade Center, which is much more well known, as well as the Pentagon on 9/11, what really happened is inside the building, incendiaries and explosives. That is, destructive materials that are designed to destroy the structure. So, how do we know? Everyone in the 9/11 truth movement is very well aware of the work of Stephen Jones, Professor Niels Harrit from Denmark, and also especially Richard Gage, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, that World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, the latter not hit by any plane on 9/11, were brought down by pre-placed massive quantities of controlled demolition charges to professionally destroy that building and bring it down in almost near free fall at gravity, acceleration speed into almost precisely their own footprint. Now, what is the link between that and the Pentagon? What I have discovered from interviews with witnesses inside the Pentagon, and I have gotten these witnesses on videotape under oath, Gary, that were provided to the Toronto hearings, to the judges. And I provided those jurate affidavits under oath sworn to the judges. The bottom line is, for instance, I'll give you compelling converging lines of evidence. The first one is the official story says that Flight 77, a very large commercial Boeing 757 commercial airliner filled with about half full of passengers, hit the plane on the west face just above the ground level, between the top level of floor one and the very bottom of floor two. Besides this being physically impossible, according to ACE pilots, Top Gun Navy pilots who have actually flown that very plane, including Captain Ralph Kolstad of the Navy, who then flew Flight 77 himself, but not on 9/11, it is impossible for a plane to have physically gone into the building at that point. But besides that, we now know from inside witnesses that there were massive explosions inside the building that went off 6 to 7 minutes before the official story says anything hit the outside. There were stopped clocks, as well as April Gallup. She's a very important inside witness at the Pentagon. Her wristwatch was stopped at the moment of the inside explosion. Within seconds of the stopped clocks in both the Navy and the Army areas, the Naval Command Center area and the Army Administration area, where April's desk was only about 35 feet from the alleged entrance hole of Flight 77, April's wristwatch was stopped. She's kept it for forensic evidence. It's in her safe deposit box. I've seen a photograph of it. I presented the evidence of her stopped wristwatch, the stopped clocks, and large numbers of interviews with people inside the Pentagon, all the way down from, I did personal interviews with the commander of the Naval Command Center on 9/11, Rear Admiral Hathaway. I did an interview with General Eberhardt, the head of NORAD. I have done an interview with the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations on 9/11, Robert Andrews, who told me that he and his aide, right after the second tower was hit, so we're talking about maybe 9:10 in the morning, had to walk over dead bodies on the inside of the inner ring. That is the A ring, just the next level is the courtyard in the center of the bullseye of the Pentagon. And the official story says that even if Flight 77's hit the building, the official story says it only barely made it through the inside of this middle ring, the C ring, and yet there are massive damages and deaths. More damage, more fire, more heat on the inner two rings beyond where the official story even says the nose of the plane went in. And I could go on and on, Gary.
All right. What does the evidence show as far as any explosives being heard, as was the case with 9/11 at the Twin Towers, versus down at the Pentagon? We haven't heard, the general public has not heard, that there was anything other than an airplane that went
in. That's correct. I marshaled all of that evidence and I presented it, and I have actually sent you the PowerPoint slides from my presentation. I sent them to either you or to Richard. But in any case, the bottom line of that is there are inside witnesses, just dozens and dozens and dozens of them. You can read their testimony that is collated on the web, same as the testimony now from the oral histories from the first responders, the policemen and the firefighters in the buildings. There are collated testimonies, and I give those quotes in my presentation. But a perfect example is, for instance, Navy Lieutenant Kevin Schaefer was in the Naval Command Center on 9/11. According to the official story in the 9/11 Commission report, he was the only survivor of the Naval Command Center, which was on the first floor, a little bit further in than the impact point. About this close to the second ring in, but the Naval Command Center, according to the official story, 43 of 44 people physically in the Naval Command Center that morning died. Kevin Schaefer was the only survivor, and his testimony is that at precisely 9:43, there was a massive explosion, a massive fireball from the center, an orange fireball from the center of the Naval Command Center going out, which killed all of those people, and he miraculously survived. April Gallup testified. She was in the Army area of the first floor of the E-Wing, which is the outside ring where the plane allegedly hit. Again, her desk was only about 35 feet from the alleged impact hole. She actually walked out of that impact hole, Gary, with her infant son who over her shoulder, whom she thought was dead that morning, and experienced going out the alleged impact hole. No fire, no jet fuel, no plane parts, no plane, no luggage, nothing connected with a plane whatsoever. She had one bare foot and walked out. We have photographs of her. Her feet are completely unburned. And the moment she pressed the on button on her computer in the Army administrative area that morning, she was a declassification expert with a top secret clearance. She pressed the on button on her computer that morning, and then she said the bomb went off. She believed it was timed with the on button of her computer. Whether it was or not, whether it was a coincidence, is more or less irrelevant. But she didn't experience any evidence whatsoever of a plane going, then walking out with what she believed was her dead infant son, Elijah, walking out of the impact hole. And her stopwatch was stopped with the explosion at 8:31. Then I interviewed the Washington Post, has a number of interviews that went online on September 11th itself. I've collated those. They're interviews by Washington Post reporters at the scene with top officers of the Pentagon who were physically inside that area. And the Pentagon rescue team said that the heat got greater going to the inside towards the courtyard beyond the third ring, that it just got hotter and hotter with more and more damage, whereas the official story says the main damage was just on the outside of the building and a little bit on the inside of the outside ring. I could go on and on.
Explain the difference in time and why the time on that person's clock, on when she hit the computer, why is that important?
It's extremely important because the official story, as embodied in the 9/11 Commission report, states very clearly that the time of the alleged impact of Flight 77, the Boeing 757 commercial airliner, on the outside of the Pentagon on 9/11, the official story says that was at exactly 9:37 and 46 seconds, almost 9:38 in the morning. April Gallup's watch, all the inside Pentagon stop clocks in the two most damaged areas, and one of them, by the way, Gary, is the official clock that's now in the 9/11 exhibition at the Smithsonian Institution. One of these clocks stopped right after 9:30. It is impossible for the damage that was made inside the Pentagon by whatever its cause was, and we have other reason to believe, I could go into, that it was in fact indeed explosives, including shaped charge explosives that are more or less plasma weapons, probably C4 plastic explosives. We know that it would be physically impossible. Even a kindergartner, logic 101 would prove to you that it's impossible for damage done at just after 9:30 to be caused by something that didn't happen until 6 or 7 minutes later.
Okay, final issue here. Let's say that, for argument's sake, that you're not finding what you would normally find after a plane crash. Bodies, luggage, parts of the plane, right?
Not there, correct.
Not there.
Yes.
That in itself, they wouldn't have all vaporized.
No, they didn't.
Okay, then another question is, was there any hard evidence that there was detonations?
Well, what do you mean by hard?
In other words, the smell of odors that emanate from
was
controlled blast.
Yes, thank you. Versus
a fuel from a jetliner.
Oh yes, I understand what you mean. Yes, there's a very, very different smell between jet fuel, which April Gallup, of course, didn't experience anyway, right close to the entrance hall, and many others didn't as well. There are many other witnesses to that I quote. However, the specific smell that was smelled by a number of witnesses who are on record is cordite, which is basically gunpowder. It's an explosive. It's a low explosive. A cordite or any low explosive, like a powder explosive, could not possibly account for all the damage. But we do have experts who have looked at the so-called exit hole on the outside of the C-ring, the middle ring, that the official story alleges the nose of the plane or some heavy part of the plane just barely popped through. We know there are photographs on the web all over the place from the Pentagon itself of this alleged exit hole. It is perfectly round, and there are experts in shaped charge explosives who have gone public and said that it is physically impossible for any impactor that has allegedly gone 310 feet through a bunch of still standing columns after the attack, when the American Society of Civil Engineers went in and cataloged the still standing columns. It's physically impossible for any impactor, after traveling 310 feet, to have made a perfectly round hole. And, in fact, he then says this hole has been made by shaped charge explosives placed on the wall of the inside of the C-ring.
Okay, we'll come back to the idea of who would have had the methods available, the security to do this, because this is one of the most secure buildings on the planet.
Correct.
And you just don't go in there and start setting up a demolition without someone paying attention.
They have to be pre-planted, just like at the World Trade Center, correct?
All right. Let's go over and say hello again to Ian. Would you give us the latest on what you have that the public may not be aware of on deconstructing the official story?
Yep, sure. Thanks very much for having me on. I mean, one thing that I just generally observe about the 9/11 issue nowadays is that we've gone from having nothing like enough information, and, you know, and we were all saying at the time, you know, why won't they tell us the full story? You know, they were hiding everything. In a sense, now we've almost got too much information. I mean, I'm supposed to know about this subject, and yet half of what Barbara said is new to me, you know. So it's very, very difficult to keep an overall picture. And I can't really offer that, you know, a picture which will explain Barbara's evidence and explain the side of the story which I've been looking at lately. But I'm sure, you know, there must be some common explanation for all this. What I'd like to tell you about is if you go along with the story of the hijackers on the planes, and, you know, a lot of what Barbara's suggesting is that this is maybe, you know, that's questionable. But, of course, you know, there are ways of weaving it in that you could imagine that possibly they did set up some, you know, hijackers to make it look as if, you know, some planes had flown into the Pentagon. So it's not contradictory. So anyway, I'm looking at the issue about the CIA's role and the FBI's role. And at the time I wrote my book, 9/11, The New Evidence, which isn't so long ago, about 3-4 years ago, we were still very short of evidence. A lot of it was all held secret still and redacted when it was released. All we really had was a 9/11 report and the footnotes. And we've now found out that, as I suspected at the time, the footnotes were inserted very much against and without the knowledge of the White House puppet guy called Philip Zelikow, who was running the 9/11 Commission. The staff has managed to squeeze quite a lot of information into those footnotes. But now that we've had a lot more come out through the Inspector General's reports in the various departments, there's a very clear picture emerging that, I mean, it's now fair to say, I've been saying this to anybody who'll listen, and it is getting through a little bit, I think, there was a conspiracy at the CIA. You know, it is no longer speculation to say that there was a conspiracy at the CIA to withhold information from the FBI and Richard Clark, who I'll just get to in a minute, very key figure at the moment, I think, Richard Clark, who was the anti-terror coordinator at the White House. Now, it's fairly clear from the 9/11 report footnotes that, you know, you've got to be pretty sympathetic, you know, to the Washington line to think that, you know, it was all sort of a mistake and that the CIA, this was the story, of course, we were all told, you know, that the CIA, they admitted that the CIA didn't pass on vital information to the FBI. They couldn't really deny it because the FBI officers who've been whistleblowers, the very brave people like Colleen Rowley and many others, they were screaming about it. So they had to admit that. But then they said, oh, well, it's all just a bit of incompetence. You know, we didn't have enough funding. We were overworked. And I said, and a lot of us said, well, hang on, you know, there's three different FBI teams here who've all been sort of called off the case on the orders of some rather, you know, the people in the middle, upper ranks of the FBI, and also colluding apparently with the people in the CIA at Alex Station at the Osama bin Laden unit. So, you know, we were all very, very suspicious, but since then, but that's not enough, you know, it's not enough for the mainstream media to try to contradict, you know, what the mainstream Washington boys are telling them, even if they wanted to, which I don't think they do. But now there's been these new developments. The Inspector General's reports, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of evidence. Of course, they're not presented as evidence of a conspiracy at the CIA. But the fact is that when you look through the small print of those Inspector General's reports, you find all those suspicions I just made that you couldn't have had coincidental incompetence. There was a decision by the CIA to withhold information about those alleged hijackers from the FBI, from Richard Clark, and that was a conspiracy. And it was probably an illegal conspiracy because the CIA had no right to operate on the mainland United States at the time. Under President Clinton's anti-terror directive, the FBI was the lead agency. Even in Yemen, the FBI were down there investigating the apparent al-Qaeda attack on the USS Cole. How much more were the FBI the lead agency in the United States on the mainland? So it's almost impossible. The only way I can think is that they were reporting directly about a secret plan to Cheney, who was the next in line after Richard Clarke. And, of course, this gels very much with what a lot of us have suspected in the first place. You know, all the lines of investigation seem to lead back to Cheney. But that is speculation. What we know now is that this decision was made in the CIA. We don't know why. We pretty much do know who made it or who operated the decision. There's certain key named people in the CIA who've now emerged as people who have a lot of questions to answer, and they should be on oath. And, you know, maybe they should be, you know, quite heavily threatened with, you know, the consequences of not telling the full truth. Now, you might say, well, you know, Ian Henshaw, who's he? Fair enough. I wouldn't expect you to take my word for this, or at least your readers, your listeners, why should they? But what we now have is Richard Clarke, who was the, I mean, everybody in America, I think, has heard of Richard Clarke, not quite so many people over here in the UK. He was the anti-terror coordinator at the White House. He's an enigmatic figure. He came in from the Clinton period. He was demoted slightly by Bush, but he was still in charge of, he was the czar in charge of anti-terrorism. Most people remember that he was the person who told the 9/11 Commission, your country failed you. And that was a bombshell, you know, that went all around the world. That was the first admission that actually, whatever you think about any conspiracies, that 9/11 attacks could have been prevented. And now we know much, much more. And he's, I don't know whether he's been, like, forced to admit this or whether he is really a whistleblowing hero. You know, only history will tell us, I think. But he's conceded that there was an agreement, you know, which is the same thing as a conspiracy, in the CIA to withhold information from the FBI and from him. And had that information been passed on, there is no doubt that the 9/11 attacks, if you follow the official story, that the 9/11 attacks would have been foiled. And there is so much detail now. And I'd just like to mention another book for anybody out there who's really interested in researching this. But believe me, this is heavy reading. Kevin Fenton, Disconnecting the Dots, How CIA and FBI Officials Helped Enable 9/11 and Evaded Government Investigations. And he has gone through, he's got 400 pages, closely written. He's been through all the Inspector General's reports. He's been through all the 9/11 Commission footnotes. He's been through the original Congressional Inquiry. And you cannot deny, it's impossible for anybody to deny now, that there was an agreement at the CIA, a conspiracy, to allow, which had the effect of allowing the 9/11 attacks to happen. Richard Clarke is not saying that that's what they intended to do. He's a lawyer. He's friends with a lot of these people. You know, it takes a lot of guts, I think, to say that George Tenet, who he was on the phone with three times a day, visits, you know, they were very, very close colleagues for quite a few years. So you cannot blame Richard Clarke for being unwilling to face the fact that, or the, you know, suspicion that this conspiracy at the CIA was aimed at allowing the 9/11 attacks to happen. But I think pretty much all the rest of us, however, you know, pro or anti-Washington we are, will conclude from this evidence that there was, well, let's take it step by step. Sorry to go on a little bit too long.
Hold on 1 second, Ian. Let me just say to our stations throughout the United States, if you're only carrying 55 minutes, we'll say goodbye to you and thank you for listening. But anybody can continue listening to this, what is going to be a little extended interview, by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Please continue, and if in your statement you would include what you now can prove and could prove in a court of law are the most detailed rebuttal of the official position.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just take it through detail by detail on the CIA, the legal position. We know that they had an agreement to withhold information from the FBI and Richard Clark. There's very few justifications for that, arguably no justification. The only real justification is that the CIA had their own parallel operation, which meant that other people needn't have intervened. But there's a huge problem with that excuse, with that defense, because their operation, if they had one at all, did not prevent the 9/11 attacks. And it should have done, because if they had those hijackers under any sort of surveillance, they would have known that they were buying tickets, most of them one-way tickets, all for the same morning of September the 11th. So, you know, it's impossible to imagine that there was another surveillance operation which was justified taking the FBI and Richard Clark off the case. So that really, this is not proof so far of anybody's guilt, because of course a lot more cross-examination, oath on testimony and so on is needed, but we have these very thorough official investigations which have people making clear statements which cannot be true to cover up the fact that they kept the FBI off the case. Now, I'm not a lawyer, I haven't looked into the strictly legal issues which would, you know, a lawyer would want to look into, but I think for the purposes of any reasonable person, we can now say that there's a very strong pool of suspicion over the CIA and how they can possibly provide any explanation for the failure to prevent the 9/11 attacks.
All right. Let us also remember that it was the CIA who were engaged in setting up the cover-up for the Gulf of Tonkin shipping strafed that didn't actually happen. And that Gulf of Tonkin attack is what allowed the administration and the hawks within the administration and the armed forces, including Curtis LeMay, to go forward with getting us into Vietnam. The CIA has been instrumental in a lot of these false flag operations. Just as a purely out-and-out hypothesis, if, I'm just thinking out loud, if we had hard evidence, which according to Linda and others, there was hard evidence because she was working as a CIA asset, and she knew, and at least 200 other people, according to her, knew well in advance, almost 4 months in advance of the 9/11, that it was going to happen, and that information went clear to the President of the United States, according to her. And then she actually met with Andy Card, who was her cousin, under Bush, and warned him, met with the Secretary of State, met with the Secretary of Defense, and warned them, you know, here's our evidence. I want to make sure you have all this evidence. Now, all they would have had to have done would have been to have arrested the people. They knew who the suspects were. They had been tailing them. They had an informant. Mossad knew who it was. German intelligence knew who it was. Pakistani intelligence knew who it was. So no one can tell us at this point that the United States government and all of its agencies were clueless about these suspected terrorists. There's too much hard evidence. But let me just finish my thought.
Yeah, no, sorry, Gary.
But if you keep the FBI out of the loop, it allows you, if you had any intent or motivation to create a false flag operation, you would have to allow the terrorists to go ahead and commit their terrorist act. You would simply use their terrorist act as your cover for bringing down the buildings and then hoping that you could control this whole thing, and the only people in America capable of that would be the CIA and its different black op operations.
And if I may
Hold on one second. Yeah.
I think that's right. I mean, whichever view you take about the planes and, you know, what happened to the Pentagon, what happened to the World Trade Center, they needed some people to be getting onto planes, according to their story. So what it's looking like is the biggest problem they had two problems. One, they needed this story to go out within minutes of the attacks, because they'd learnt from Oklahoma that if you delay the putting out your story, the truth might come out. That was a terrible mistake, the way Timothy McVeigh was caught. They were trying to blame that on Arab terrorists as well at the time. Most people have forgotten that. So they had to be able to get the story out really, really fast. The only way they could do that was by saying, we've just had a look at the flight manifests, and these have got known Al-Qaeda terrorists on. That's how we knew they were known terrorists. They can't say, oh, well, we'll look into it. Oh, yeah, we found out a day later. That's a day's a long time when something like that happens. You know, reporters get to work, and you have to get that story out absolutely immediately. So they had to have known Al-Qaeda terrorists getting on the planes. But then the problem was, how do you stop them getting caught by the FBI first, which is, of course, exactly what happened with Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker. They did catch him. That is their problem. And the explanation is that the CIA, one of their main tasks was keeping the FBI off the job. That is, though, in a sense, conjecture. But if people are asking, what's the explanation for all this? You know, what was really going on? I think that's the answer.
Okay. You have some additional comments, Barbara?
Yes, I'd just like to make a comment about the FBI's involvement in the operation vis-a-vis the CIA. And also, I've interviewed Richard Clark, so I'd just like to summarize what he told me. Which is a little bit different than the story he's now putting out through this new interview. And that interview that he just did, by the way, or that's just come out on the 11th or the 10th anniversary, was actually done in 2009. But in any case, the first comment I have is that the FBI, the CIA, I agree that there was a CIA conspiracy, that the CIA was at the center of the conspiracy of the real inside job. But because they needed to keep the operational FBI off the job and not interfere with the hijackers, who they needed to go forward to be their cover story for the inside the building explosives, both at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, they needed to have people in key managerial positions inside the FBI to stop Colleen Rowley from getting permission to go into Moussaoui's computer, etc. And we know those individuals. It's Dave Frasca.
Yep.
We know them by name. And they need to be subpoenaed. They need to be brought into a court of law. And this information needs to be made public. Now, I did interview Richard Clark, and I just want to summarize what he told me. It's extremely important. Richard Clark is a very interesting individual. I believe that Richard Clark he's been put under classification. He's not able to say everything he knows, but he is saying everything that he can say. And one of the things that he did tell me, there is no question that he was kept out of the loop in my mind inside the White House. He even complained to that effect that Condoleezza Rice demoted him as soon as they came into the White House and kept him out of key meetings. He was desperately trying to have the new counterterrorism policy brought to a high-level working group, a cabinet council, which only happened on September 4th. But despite that fact, he still knows a lot. And what Richard Clark told me, and this was in my capacity as the senior military affairs journalist at the Department of Defense's premier science, technology, and national security university, which position I held for over a decade until I retired about 3 months ago. And when I was still in that position, approximately a year ago, I interviewed Richard Clark as part of my official position, and I published what I'm about to tell you he vetted it, he approved what I'm about to tell you, and it's still online on an official DOD website. This is what he told me. He said that we, that means the whole apparatus, the national security, Homeland Security apparatus, what we now call Homeland Security after 9/11, we exercised the 9/11 attack scenario 5 times before 9/11. And that the White House approves every major military emergency response exercise. And Webster Tarpley, who is a major researcher for decades, Webster Tarpley was a speaker at the big 9/11 conference that, Gary, both you and I were also speakers at yesterday. I don't know if you saw his talk. But Webster Tarpley was the next to the last talk before Wayne Madsen. And Webster Tarpley has followed my original line of research. I was the first researcher to discover and publish that there were hijack scenario exercises being carried out, actually operationally carried out, on the morning of 9/11 by NORAD Northeast Sector NEADS by Colonel Robert Marr on the scenario, very close to the scenario of the actual alleged hijack attacks, and that Those were exercised, we now know from Richard Clark, five times. The one on 9/11 was the fifth. That exercise was made to go live. That was the modus operandi of the planning, the execution, and the cover-up of the actual attack. And Richard Clark knows that, but he was, I do not believe, part of it. Richard Clark actually has gone public with the fact in his book, Against All Enemies. I think it's page 5. It's the only place in his entire book which had to be pre-vetted by the White House itself, by the Bush-Cheney White House. There's only one place in the book that has three dots, dot, 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 which means it's been censored out. And that is where he mentions that there were what he calls war games or exercises by NORAD NEADS that morning called Vigilant Guardian. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Webster Tarpley yesterday revealed that he now has a list of 46 9/11 scenario-related exercises leading up to and at least a half dozen on the morning of 9/11 itself.
Can I add a little vignette to that? That's fantastic research, Barbara. So glad you've told us all about that. I have to admit that I didn't know that Richard Clark had been quite so explicit in this other interview. This is something that a lot of people haven't noticed. Barbara, I dare say, has, though. The 9/11 Commission put it on the record that the Pentagon told them that Andrew Marr's tapes, the tapes from that NEADS center, that they were erased and they weren't able to reclaim them. And it's that Ben Vernisty, I think, put it on the 9/11 Commission record that they actually went down out into the field, seized those tapes, and were able to reclaim them. And what they contained was basically that confirmation of the anti-hijack exercise that was running that morning.
Correct.
I mean, I've been going on about this as well, Barbara, for a few years now. It's very clear that they were running an anti-hijack exercise that morning.
Yes.
And as Richard Clark says in his book, you know, a lot of these exercises, you can't say that of the anti-hijack exercise. This is a bombshell to me, what you've just said.
Yes, should be.
That, you know, that some of these exercises are hyper-realistic.
Yes.
They might have had fake people pretending to be calling the relatives. You know, there's a lot you can do.
But that's exactly how they did the. That's exactly how they did it, Ian. And not only that, in the book Touching History by Lynn Spencer, pages 3-6 and 24-27, you will read that she has now interviewed Colonel Robert Marr, who is the battlefield operational director of NORAD Northeast Sector on 9/11, where all three alleged hijacks attacks happened. And Colonel Marr, you will find out in there, he is just before he took the job as battlefield director of NORAD NEADS on 9/11, not too long before 9/11, by the way. His expertise and the job he had just before was as director of Red Team Exercise Verisimilitude. Got it. It's bingo.
Yeah.
It's bingo.
Can you just give us the reference for that interview you just mentioned, please,
yes,
again, Barbara?
Yes. Well, you know, I'm here with Cynthia McKinney in New York, and you just called her, and I've got your email. I'm going to send it, the whole article, to you.
Fantastic.
And
Cynthia is a great person, isn't she?
Yes.
I tell you what I like about Cynthia. She's careful about what she says in public, you know, because it's so easy to, you know, if you just say one thing once that doesn't, you know, that can be used against you. And so many people have discredited themselves like that. We've had some terrible cases, one or two terrible cases over here, you know, just saying a little bit too much, saying something that's not quite correct, maybe a swear word by mistake because you get so angry sometimes when you think about this.
Yes.
But Cynthia's great. We've had her over here in London.
Cynthia is, in fact, Gary, at the beginning of this discussion with the other guest who's here in the studio with me, mentioned that he was wondering what potential American politician might be a true spiritually honest person, and the answer is Cynthia McKinney.
I thank you both for being with us today. Sorry we ran over into the next program, but it was important information. Barbara, we look forward to more information and a more in-depth discussion with you.
Thank you.
And Ian, always nice to have you on. We look forward to continuing our dialogue.
Thanks very much for having me.
His website is reinvestigate911.org. Her website is...
I don't have a website, but you can contact me at this email, pentagonattackpapers, that's plural with an S, at gmail.com.
Thank you very much. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Oh, and it's 7 o'clock tonight, Progressive Commentary Hour. I hope you join me. Have a nice day.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.